Welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. In a moment, we'll be discussing the history of one of America's best-known cultural elements, the motel, with Jefferson Rogers, a professor of geography at the University of Tennessee in Martin. So don't go away. But first, let's look back at this week, August 31st through September 6th, in history. On August 31st, 1965, many of us remember, the United States made it a crime to burn draft cards. On September 2nd, 1620, 102 pilgrims boarded the Mayflower and set sail for the New World. The Revolutionary War finally came to an end with the signing of the Treaty of Paris on September 3rd, 1783. On September 5th, 1939, the United States affirmed its neutrality in the Second World War, and NBC aired the first episode of Star Trek on September 6th, 1966. Turning to this week's history in the news, the tragic shooting at the nation's capital in late July has raised some questions concerning the history of violent acts in that public building. Researchers have identified at least 10 such acts, beginning in January 1835, when Richard Lawrence fired two pistols at President Andrew Jackson while he was visiting the Capitol. 15 years later, during the debate over the Compromise of 1850, Mississippi Senator Henry Foote had to be restrained from shooting Missouri Senator Thomas Hart Benton. However, in 1856, following a similar debate, South Carolina Congressman Preston Brooks succeeded in beating with his cane Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner on the Senate floor. Charles Kincaid, a correspondent for the Louisville Times, shot former Kentucky Congressman William Talby in February of 1890, while in July 1915, Eric Munter, a former Harvard professor, set off a bomb in the Capitol. In December 1932, Martin Kemmerer was persuaded to drop a gun, with which he threatened members of the House of Representatives, but in July of 1947, William Kaiser actually managed to get a shot off at Ohio Senator John Bricker. Acts of violence stepped up a bit in March of 1954 when Puerto Rican nationalist extremists shot five congressmen on the floor of the House of Representatives. In March 1971, a bomb exploded in a Senate restroom, injuring no one. And finally, a similarly harmless but quite destructive bomb ripped through the second floor of the building in November of 1983. So what happened this past July was not the first, and unfortunately will probably not be the last act of violence in the nation's capital. You are listening to Talking History. Well, what can be more American for a nation obsessed with the automobile than the motel, one of America's more unique contributions to the world? That's the subject of this week's interview, in which Talking History's Robert Hopkins speaks with Jefferson Rogers of the University of Tennessee in Martin. Robert?
Thank you, Brian. For most Americans growing up in the 50s and 60s, summer meant a painful road trip to visit a tourist mecca such as Disneyland. To a young boy or girl trapped in the backseat for hours upon end, the highlight of each day's long, long drive was finally arriving at some roadside motel. There in the brutal evening heat of Needles, California, the kids would burn away that excess energy while splashing and laughing in the pool, all the while building wonderful childhood memories. For Mom and Dad, however, the evening stay in the clapboard motel was filled with fear of unnamed crawling creatures, linen of questionable cleanliness, paper-thin walls separating noisy or indiscreet neighbors, and a dripping faucet guaranteed to keep anyone awake. Despite this stereotyped vision, roadside motels have been an integral part of the mobilization of America. Our guest today has looked at, and no doubt stayed in, hundreds of motels all over the United States and assembled a fascinating portrait of this important component of American culture. Dr. Jefferson S. Rogers is Assistant Professor of Geography at the University of Tennessee at Martin. Along with John Jekyll and Keith Scully, he is the author of The Motel in America, published in 1996 by Johns Hopkins University Press. Welcome, Dr. Rogers. Why is the motel such an important part of America's background, its culture, its heritage? What is it that makes it special?
I'll tell you, several things come to mind. One of those would be just simply how huge it is as an industry now in America. It consists now of about 69,000 properties. And lodging now generates about $70 billion in revenues, and it employs over 1.5 million people. So we have just simply a huge industry now from coast to coast. Another thing that comes to mind is that motels serve people in communities and serve travelers in many different important ways. Of course, they provide basic shelter, but they also are community meeting places. They're meeting places for relatives coming in from out of town. They now have entertainment venues. You can think of them as honeymoon havens, important places in people's lives. And they're also places of escape for a lot of people. And I think the most extreme example might be what's in the news with Dr. Kevorkian. Sometimes he does his gruesome work at motels. And so many different ways motels play a role in our lives.
So in many ways, these hotels are little homes away from home. They carry what we experience in our homes to a different location. Is that why they're so popular with particular chains or brands?
Well, it's sort of a yes and no type of thing when it comes to home away from home. It's on the yes side, they do provide sort of what every home has, a bed, bathroom, walls, roofs, even a TV. And the consistency, you know, with chains from motel to motel, from city to town to city, maintains a certain predictability and a sense of familiarity that, of course, comes with going home every evening from work. But on the other hand, you could say no to that because motels sort of lack the personal touches of a home, the colors, levels of cleanliness, the smells that develop in a home. You also have different neighbors for every different night. And the last thing is that with a motel, you're only good as long as you can pay. Usually at home, you can stay there for as long as you want.
So for the traveler, for example, the hotel, the motel, is as much a home away from home, provided that you've got the ability to be away from home. If you need an extra shelter, you need an extra place. Without that, you're really on your own. Is that correct?
That's right. We're in a capitalist society, and no one's going to let you in free of charge.
What about hotels and motels in terms of charity? We've experienced recently some very severe weather. You mentioned tornadoes. Where do people go? Do hotels and motels respond to these in a charitable way, or are they still there to make their money?
I'd say both. You know, often you hear in the news, for example, a blizzard across I-80 there in Nebraska or the floods in North Dakota. We've recently had some tornadoes down here in Tennessee, Mid-South. And motels will open their doors to people, but often it's still for a charge. They may reduce the fee, but they'll still ask for some money in return. It's a capitalist society we are living in.
Is there any difference here, not only in terms of how hotels treat their guests, but simply in terms of the future of these hotels, between hotel chains and the mom-and-pop hotel?
Well, I'll tell you, when you go to a mom-and-pop motel, you do get a very different feeling as to how you're being treated. It's a little bit more welcoming, a little bit more homey. They're going to tell you more about sort of the town if you ask about what's a good restaurant. When you go into a chain motel, it's more like you're another reservation on the list, and nothing more than that. So from my own personal experiences, there is a real difference in sort of the way you're treated.
Why do you think Americans, though, embrace or are willing to become simply a reservation, and they would rather go to a big chain despite the disadvantages, the impersonal nature, than to go to a mom-and-pop hotel?
Well, the impersonal nature does have its advantages. Some people do go to motels to escape. They don't want to be known. They don't want to have any attention paid to them. So there's some people that just simply prefer that. Another thing about chains is just simply the sheer consistency. When you're on the road, you're limited in money, you're limited in time, and you're just not really willing to risk a surprise, risk a bad night, the drippy faucet that you're talking about, the thin walls, the undesirable neighbors. When you go to a chain, you know what to expect in price, you know what to expect generally in quality, and you know just about how you're going to be treated. That certainty makes them that trip a little less stressful. So that's another big reason.
Well, as I read through your book here, I at times chuckled with glee your remarks about the those tiny bars of soap, and then at other times I was equally frustrated. How much time have you spent in hotels and motels doing this sort of research?
Well, I didn't go to the motels themselves just simply to do the research. A lot of it was done archivally, but I have traveled a lot. As a geographer, I'm sort of born to travel, I suppose. I've been doing this ever since with family vacations when I was a little kid. And of course, I went to the University of Kansas. I grew up in New Mexico, so a lot of trips going between college and home. And then I did a dissertation that was a little bit distant, so a lot of hotel travel there. So I've just sort of picked it up as a customer rather than as a scholar. Some of the more factual nature stuff, that was done in the library and interviewing people.
So what have you seen over the past many years in the evolution of hotels and motels? Tell us about the 20s and 30s. How did it all begin?
Well, motels actually started out like campgrounds. You could consider them as what you'd find maybe in a national park, where you have sort of a basic open field, a place to park the car, and you prop up a tent or maybe sleep in the car. Nothing more than that. These auto camps were something that began all around the World War I era and into the interwar era. Then they evolved. People became a little bit more affluent, became maybe a little bit more demanding, and we start seeing, for example, cabin camps opening up. This would be, for example, the auto camp, the campground itself. They'd build a very rudimentary square little cabin and have a bed, and that's about it. There would be a central place in the campground with a bath, showers, toilets, and that would be it. That was into the 1920s, 1930s. And again, as people became more affluent, more demanding, as more and more people were traveling by car, they evolved into what we call cottage camps. And these are basically the cabins that have been upgraded. They might now have a shower and a toilet. They might have a little carport to put your car in. They might actually have a better heating system. And so we start seeing that showing up in the 1930s. They eventually evolve into what we consider now, I guess, a motel. These motor courts where you'd actually have a pretty well-furnished room. And these evolved into motor inns and now suite hotels and everything else they see by the roadside.
Well, many Americans nowadays, as you mentioned earlier, are satisfied with the brands, the big chain hotels, for that sense of reliability. And there's a perception, perhaps, that the roadside motels, the mom-and-pop hotels, are really becoming the venues of lower-class travelers, bikers, the scene of criminal behavior or illicit rendezvous. Is this really the future of the non-chain, mom-and-pop sort of hotel?
Maybe for a few. I'll tell you, part of the research for the book, we took a close look at the city of Albuquerque, looked at the evolution of motels, actually mapped them out from about 1920 to 1990. And I took a special look at a segment of Old Route 66. And back in 1950, during sort of the peak of motels in Albuquerque in terms of number and their sort of spread across the city, there was this one segment, about maybe five blocks long, that had 14 motels. Fast forward to 1990, there's only four left. What happens is that a lot of these mom-and-pop motels, they're sold, the land use changes, and they're either torn down completely, and so they're physically gone from the landscape, or they're converted to other uses. In some cases, they're rehabbed, refurbished, reinvented, and very nice places to stay. And so, sort of as motels go, they're either going to disappear, get refurbished, or converted to other uses. And it'll just be a handful that sort of devolve into, as you describe, sort of biker palaces and such.
Well, have these new hotels, or perhaps with those that are more committed to chains and a national clientele, have they been more receptive to egalitarian accommodations? That is, have they embraced people of all races, all classes, or are there still those problems associated with someone peeking out the window prior to registering a guest?
Well, it's more prevalent, of course, with the mom-and-pop chains. With companies, there tends to be corporate policy that says, you know, you have to accept a paying guest. Now, with that, I still have to give a qualification. When I, for example, was a front desk clerk for Holiday Inn, and it was a four-star Holiday Inn, a pretty good one, our owner and the managers made it quite clear to us and said, you do not have to check in any guest you are not comfortable with. And so they gave desk clerks, even at a four-star Holiday Inn, discretion to turn people away, even if we had plenty of rooms. Mom and pops, though, traditionally have been quite sort of careful to who they let in. I was interviewing someone down in Jackson, Tennessee, that ran a mom and pop motel for a number of decades, and he would literally check license plates just to make sure they weren't local. He would refuse African Americans from staying. So we've seen that in the past. We still see it in the present.
So hotels are in many ways just a microcosm of American society, that the same problems that afflict all of society are still part and parcel of the motel community.
That's right.
You mentioned the Holiday Inn, and you also discussed that at length in your book, sort of as the revolutionary motel chain. How would the other chains tend to respond to that, thinking especially of like J.W. Marriott and his commitment to bring both food and lodging to an economical traveling community? Why Holiday Inn?
I think Holiday Inn is the undisputed sort of leader of modern franchise motels. What Holiday Inn did was sometimes not completely innovative. They weren't maybe the first to do it, but they're the ones to do it very well and throughout the system and consistently. They were a very aggressive chain in pursuing certain strategies. I think J.W. Marriott would applaud Kimmins Wilson, the founder of Holiday Inn, for what he created. What Holiday Inn did, for example, was, for example, introduce flat rate pricing. Kimmins Wilson didn't like the way that motels would charge extra for children, so he made sure there was a flat rate. Children stayed for free. You only paid for the adults. And he also wanted to make sure that every Holiday Inn had consistent amenities, an ice machine. There would be a swimming pool. There would be kennels. There would be a chaplain on call. And then there was reservation systems. This is where Holiday Inn was innovative. They have a system called Holodex. And 1964 or so, Kimmins Wilson was fascinated by computers, and so he talked to IBM about using computers to develop a nationwide reservation network. Decided to go with it, invested a big sum of money. He says it could have broken the chain if it had been a flop, but it turned out to be a smashing success. Not only it helped them book rooms in advance anywhere in the country instantly, it was also a way to keep the Holiday Empire together. Motels could be monitored by the home office in terms of how many rooms they were selling, what their inventory and supply was like, what their profits were like, how much revenue they were generating, and at the same time, the individual motels could be instantly connected with the home office in Memphis. And so this is one other thing that they were able to do. More modern times, they've segmented into different brands. They've been a leader in that. So we now have, for example, all these different motel chains within a chain. Holiday Inn has been a leader in that. So Holiday Inn stands out really as sort of the leading company in modern franchise motels.
Well, this brings us up, of course, to the present day. In our short time remaining, could you give us a vision of what the motel of the future will be like? Will it still have those nasty little bars of soap?
They certainly will. They're going to get smaller and waxier. Actually, what I see is the motels becoming more and more segmented. We're going to see more and more of these chains within a chain as companies try to figure out the best way to create a product that's going to meet specific needs for specific types of travelers. And so this is a trend I think we're going to continue to see. I think we're going to see a further sort of geographic separation of motels. We're going to see sort of the high-end players at the high-demand locations, like interstate interchanges. We're going to see mom-and-pops sort of further marginalized into the older parts of strips. And so we're going to see a separation there. So those are two major changes that I see coming in the future. Also, I guess, lastly, is motels and rooms becoming smaller as land becomes more scarce, more expensive. So rooms are going to get more small, and the grounds around them are going to sort of shrink. It's going to be more asphalt, less landscaping.
Well, I know many of our listeners today are on the road. They're on that summer vacation. They're probably looking for a motel, and what you've told us today tells us a great deal about what they can expect to find and why that's the case. Well, we've been talking today with Jefferson Rogers, geographer, motel scholar at the University of Tennessee, Martin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. And apropos our discussion of the history of the motel in America, we've picked as our site of the week one of the nation's best-known roads. Here to tell us about it is Talking History's producer, Cindy Workman. Cindy?
Thank you, Brian. For historical site of the week, we've picked one for the adventuresome traveler and nostalgia buff, Route 66, which spans 8 states, beginning just outside of Chicago and ending in California. Though it hasn't been used much since interstates began taking over in 1966, and even though it was officially decommissioned in 1985, Route 66 still exists for those who want to find it. Dubbed the Mother Road by John Steinbeck and made famous by a TV show and a Corvette, Route 66 contains a treasure trove of old country cooking, motels with big neon signs, and tourist traps. A search on the internet brings more information and stories than you can read in a day, and the book recommended as a must-read for those who wish to travel what's left of Route 66 is The Mother Road, Route 66 by Michael Wallace. Oh, and by the way, Route 66 ends at the pier in Santa Monica, California, and you may want to head from there to Universal Studios, where the infamous Bates Motel sits atop a hill in the back lot.
If you have planned to motor west, travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Is free speech still under threat? That's the subject of this week's Radio Op-Ed piece, our regular segment in which we invite historians to give their perspective on subjects in the news. Our guest this week is James M. Banner, Jr., independent historian and writer living in Washington, D.C. Dr. Banner is co-director of the History News Service and author, most recently with Harold Cannon, of The Elements of Teaching, published by Yale University Press. His remarks come to us courtesy of the History News Service.
Is all well with freedom of the press and expression in the United States? It would seem so, given the latitude of language and the range of image now available to most Americans. Yet 200 years after the enactment of the first and most notorious U.S. law abridging free speech and expression, the Sedition Act of 1798, there remain troubling signs that freedom of speech remains under threat in the United States. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. After all, American society is now among the world's most complex. More people of different cultures, religious, ethnic, racial, and sexual, live here than probably any place else on Earth. One should expect clashes about ideas and images, and resulting efforts to muzzle the expression of those that may shock or offend some people in a nation of such diverse origins, practices, and views. Which, of course, is all the more reason why vigilance is required against efforts to suppress what such a diverse body of citizens must and wants to know. Take, for example, the fact that public libraries must often fight to keep on their shelves books that some people find offensive, and that films, such as the recent production of Nabokov's Lolita, have trouble finding U.S. distributors because some people don't like their subjects. These are precisely the kind of limits on the rights of citizens to have access to all ideas and of writers to present life in all its variety that people 200 years ago so feared. The Sedition Act of 1798 was passed during the Republic's infancy, when foreign threats to the nation abounded, and when many people lacked confidence that their new and unprecedented constitutional government would survive. One way to help preserve it, some people believed, was to place restrictions by act of Congress on the criticism of public officials, that is, on seditious libel. So Congress criminalized utterances which called the actions of government officials, most of them then members of the Federalist Party, into question. Soon, journalists and congressmen such as Matthew Lyon of Vermont, a member of the opposition Democratic Republican Party, were jailed for criticizing their Federalist opponents. Private citizens were hauled into court for uttering supposedly seditious words. But in the first political test of the First Amendment, the outcry against the law quickly backfired against its authors. It so clouded the prospect of the Federalists that they lost control of Congress and the presidency in 1800 and saw the hated Sedition Act lapse. Many people, including Congressman Lyon, who gained re-election from his jail cell, were vindicated for speaking what they considered the truth. The American tradition of civil liberties was born. But more than that then came into being. The basic principles that govern the distinctly American approach to expression, principles since codified into First Amendment law and enacted each day that we can purchase the books we want, read what the journalists report in their news stories, and create the art we wish to create and see the art we wish to see, then saw their birth too. Thomas Jefferson once declared, in words now cut into the marble of his memorial in Washington, that error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. But his views have not always been heeded. Abolitionists were stoned for their views in the 1830s, a wartime sedition act was passed in 1918, and the KKK, however vile its views, is often prevented even today from expressing them. So on the bicentenary of one of the most hated pieces of legislation in our history, we should remember Jefferson's words each time we read a book snatched off a library shelf for its offensiveness to some citizens, or of someone trying to muzzle someone else's words. There may be no Sedition Act on the books today, and few limits on free expression, but the forces that would suppress free speech and press remain in the land to threaten us.
You've been listening to James Banner, historian and co-director of the History News Service.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, and the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters.
And finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else that might interest our listeners, it's been 1 year since the world mourned the death of Princess Diana. On Monday, August 31st, the History Channel will explore Diana's life leading up to the tragedy on As It Happened, The Diana Effect, Legacy of a Princess. And Arriba, The History of Flight in Mexico, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean, opens this week in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington. The exhibit, which runs through November 30th, includes photographs, models, and personal anecdotes about Latin America's aviation personalities. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week for our special Labor Day program. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.